Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tens of thousands of Egyptians protesting in Tahrir Square today are demanding that former President Hosni Mubarak and his family be put on trial for corruption. According to the Associated Press, this is one of the largest protests since Mubarak stepped down in February. These protests come one day after protests at Cairo University against the dean, a prominent member of Mubarak's National Democratic Party. This revolution is far from over, so let us go live to Cairo now and talk to WNYC's own Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media. She is in Cairo this week. Hey, Brooke, hello from New York.
Hello, Brian. And I was at both those demonstrations.
So give me your first impressions of the demonstrations Egyptian style, since this is your first taste.
Well, it really is remarkable, because what you're essentially seeing is a mini revolution happening across almost every institution in the country. One expert in Egypt has observed that, and this is true of all dictatorships, that any institution supported by a dictatorship tends to resemble the dictatorship in its use of corruption and bullying and cronyism and nepotism and graft. And so institutions across the nation are undergoing right now the same kind of revolt. That's what we saw at Cairo University the other day. And today in Tahrir Square, you know, it was, yes, they want Hosni Mubarak put on trial, but what they basically want is a sense that the revolution is continuing, because really, in fact, with all those people still in place, it's far from over.
What's the mood in Cairo?
The mood in Cairo, you know, and usually I resist questions like that because, you know, how do I know? But it's so unmistakable that that I actually don't feel hesitant to characterize it. It's this enormous amount of hope combined with apprehension. And, you know, in a way, it feels sort of like, you know, people who are having a party while waiting for the hurricane to hit the house and blow everything away. So there's a party atmosphere, but it's one with a purpose. You can go meeting hopping here. As we attended one event after another, people would say, "Are you going to the Libyan event?" And you know, right in front of our hotel was an event for Yemen. This is about more than just Egypt. It's about the whole region.
And when you say hope and apprehension all mixing, I mean, it would be lovely to think that this is all about an Arab Spring democracy movement and everything's going in the right direction. But, of course, it steps forward and steps backwards in unpredictable combinations. I'm just looking at what's moved on the wires just since our program started this morning from Syria. A witness says 13 protesters have been killed in southern Syria during an anti-government demonstration. From Libya, the UN Children's Agency says snipers are targeting children in the besieged rebel-held Libyan city of Misrata. Going out of the region but to another country being closely watched. In Kashmir, in India, police say a blast outside a mosque has killed a prominent Muslim religious leader in the Indian portion of Kashmir, and on and on and on.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing time that we're living in. It's a time where people are asserting themselves against very deeply entrenched powers, and it's very rare that sort of thing happens in a velvet revolution sort of way.
And listeners, do you have a question for Brooke while she's in Cairo this week? Egyptian Americans want to weigh in, perhaps, on the post-Mubarak Egypt so far, or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or a question on our website. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. The New York Times today, Brooke, quotes Ahab al-Karat, a psychiatrist organizing a new political party. He said, quote, "Democracy is not just about electoral ballots and politics at the national level. It's about how you run your organization, how you run your small neighborhood. It's about having a say in every aspect of your life." unquote. So is it accurate to say that no established institution is immune at this moment to Egyptians who want to see change?
I think that it's very accurate to say that. It certainly is true in the media, which is the area that I've been focusing on. At the longest lived paper in the region, or one of them, Al Ahram, was founded in 1875. It has suffered such a tremendous drought of credibility among the Egyptians that now its editorial staff wants to be able to essentially elect its editor and elect all the desk heads. Can you imagine such a thing happening at the New York Times, which at one time back in the 1950s, Al-Ahram was compared to the New York Times?
And is it a coincidence that the Cairo University demonstration was at the journalism school?
No coincidence at all. The dean of the journalism school there was a well-known crony of Hosni Mubarak, helped write his speeches. During the time, he was one of the people over the course of the revolution that, rather than keeping his head down, was straightforwardly defending the Mubarak regime. He's regarded basically as a shameful face of a journalism school that has produced very, very skilled professionals who for generations had been unable to practice their profession with the skills that they learned in Egypt. Many of them have gone to Al Jazeera or the BBC, and a number of them are returning now. But there are still red lines in the media here. I mean, it used to be you couldn't talk about Mubarak and his family in anything other than the most glowing terms. Now you have no problem discussing their corruption. That draft of history is being written. But what about the current draft? I mean, there's really only one power left, and there is still a big, thick red line around it in the state media, and that is the military. However, online is a very different story.
Let's take a phone call. Albert in New Jersey. Where in New Jersey are you, Albert?
Edison.
Hi.
Hi. So my question would be, are there any similarities, or does anyone see similarities between the lack of support for Mubarak in 2011 and the lack of American support for Nasser during the early 1950s following his coup over the king?
I haven't heard that. I mean, one thing that's been said here over and over again, whether inside the country or outside the country, is that this is truly a homegrown revolution. This doesn't seem to have much to do with outside powers at all, except perhaps the example that was provided by Tunis and Tunisia. But other than that, this was something that has grown over a long period of time, really starting with something called the Kefaya movement in 2004, the Enough movement, and then the April 6th movement, which was a labor sympathy movement, and then finally all of these different groups coalescing on Tahrir Square to remove Mubarak in January.
Thank you, Albert. On the media is Brooke Gladstone in Cairo. Brooke, what many people may not know about you, even if they listen to On the Media, is that you were an NPR Moscow correspondent at the time that country, Russia, was transitioning from the communist era to the post-communist era. Do you see any similarities with respect to the media or in other ways being in Egypt now?
God, I cannot believe you asked me that question, because I've been thinking, am I just seeing this country through Moscow eyes? I've been feeling it everywhere. The noise in the street, the dust in the air, crammed into these little cabs, and the feelings, the little speeches that everybody gives when you talk to them about hope and the future, and it isn't over yet, and it's time to build something new. Particularly crammed into the cabs, I thought this. I had this incredible feeling of deja vu, and then I looked and I thought it was a Lada. It was a Russian car, and all the cabs are Russian here, and maybe that's part of what it was. But really the sensibility, the sense of dignity that people are feeling, the sense of possibility. I think more than anything, it's the sense of possibility. But there is also a sense that this hope could easily be squandered, and there is a tremendous desire to just remove these layers and layers of corrupt bureaucrats that stand between the people in the street and what they think is their right to participate in this society. And in Russia, those people never really went away.
212-433-WNYC. Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Oh, we have a terrible buzz on your line, but get right to your point. All right, we will try Susan again if we can clean up that line. Brooke, are people talking about the turmoil in the other Arab states that has begun since Mubarak resigned, Libya, Syria, Bahrain, etc.? Do they look at it with the pride of having opened up a wave of people power, or trepidation at, oh my God, look what we've unleashed, or just see it as unrelated altogether? Are you able to get a sense of that?
Oh, there's no way that you can avoid the connection that people feel here with all of these other struggles going on in the rest of the region. They feel neither a sense of responsibility nor a sense of, disconnection. What they feel is a sense of solidarity. I mean, as I mentioned, you can go to a Stand with Libya rally followed by a Yemen rally. There, people are carrying in Tahrir Square. People were carrying Libyan flags, and people were talking about Bahrain. There is a tremendous sense that this isn't just one struggle, that it's a regional struggle, and that it isn't over here. And I think that's why they feel so connected to those other places.
Yes, it isn't over.
They may be a step or two ahead.
It isn't over there, as evidenced by the fact that there are these demonstrations this week, which is one of the reasons that you're there and one of the reasons that we're doing this segment. So do they see the success of their own movement ultimately as dependent on the successes of these movements in Libya, Tunisia, other Middle Eastern countries, and where they wind up, not only where they start?
Actually, that's a really interesting question. I don't think so. I don't think that the Egyptians feel that their success is contingent on success in Libya. But what they feel is that they are, one step along in this process, and there's a fervent hope and a desire that they're able to take some of the region with them.
Let's try Susan again. Susan, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I have two questions about the new Egypt. Can we be optimistic that military abuses will stop, and can we be optimistic that women will have equal rights?
You've been there 4 days, Brooke. You can answer those questions, right?
Well, I can tell you this, that there is an enormous amount of work being done documenting abuses by the military and holding them responsible. And even if people aren't seeing those reports on state television or in state newspapers yet, they are seeing them online, and they are being picked up from those online documented sources onto the foreign media, like the BBC, like Al Jazeera, like American newspapers. That's how you know about them. And that is coming back round to the military, and the military has been forced to respond to some of these abuses. And if the monitoring continues and the pressure keeps up, I think that, that they will have to answer for it. They don't want a bloodbath or another revolution on their hands. I do think that's true, but it isn't going to be easy.
From a media standpoint, has the military been difficult to cover?
The military, it's funny. When you talk to somebody at the big state newspaper, Aram, they'll say, of course, we don't have any red lines here, except that, when you leave the building, they say that they do. But there's also, I spoke to one reporter who's done some very critical reporting over the years, even on her own newspaper. And she said that, I am a patriot, and this is the one institution that's holding the country together. It is that kind of notion that some people, that it's that kind of view that some people hold of the military. The military is keeping chaos, is rampant Islamic fundamentalism, hordes of thugs off the street. This is an idea that the military likes to propagate. Others say that, you know, if they're picking up legitimate dissenters and demonstrators along with the thugs and treating them brutally, then, you know, then they don't get a pass.
And Susan's other question was about the sense that you're getting of optimism or not with respect to women's rights.
It's very interesting. I've raised this question over and over again with women reporters, women activists, and I have to say that I get frequently a rolling of the eyes. They say, you know, this is a nation, you know, this isn't Saudi Arabia, these aren't the Gulf states. You know, women have, many women are very active and highly placed in organizations all across the, you know, all across all parts of society. This isn't a culture that suffers enormously from inequality compared with the rest of the region. And, you know, I think some of them would say, you know, we don't make less than less than males with the same job,
right,
you know, dollar to dollar any more than women in the States.
Right.
Do.
I think the question from an American standpoint really comes down to whether they're afraid of retrenchment over there because of the possible rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had not been in power. Do you find that concern on women's lips?
Actually, I don't. And part of the thing is that there isn't, you know, there is wariness of the Muslim Brotherhood, but there is not real fear. For one thing, the Muslim Brotherhood was actually stronger in some sense before the revolution because it was the only alternative to the Mubarak regime. So some people who would actually sign up or align themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood, not out of a sense of religious fervor, but because it was the only political alternative. There was a recent vote, and I wish I could be more specific, on a camp in which the Muslim Brotherhood had done quite well in the past, and post-revolution, not nearly so well, because there were so many other political options to choose from.
On the media's Brooke Gladstone in Cairo, have you looked up Wael Ghanim, the Google executive who helped launch the Tahrir Square movements with his anonymous posts back in January?
Actually, we did try to find Mr. Ghanim, and what happened, Sarah? He doesn't appear to be in the country right now. We made some effort to find him, but you know, for all I know, he's resting up somewhere else.
I wonder if it's too hot for an internet organizer. There has been concern that the secular young generation, Facebook, you know, crowd that was the impetus behind the original protests is really being marginalized by the military and the religious establishment. Do you get that impression one way or the other?
That is certainly the presumption that I came here with, and I have to say that it has in no way been borne out by what I have seen.
Huh.
These people are incredibly active. They're incredibly connected. Remember, this is a very young region. I mean, there's a huge number of people under the age of 30. And these people are computer literate, and they're very, very politically relevant. Now, whether or not the people who are still in power will attempt to close them out is an open question that I can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that they will be able to do that easily. It was very clear just from the demonstration today in Tahrir Square that that they're not going away.
Before you go, Brooke, how is the Egyptian press covering the United States and President Obama there? What are people are saying? What are people saying about the U.S. involvement in Libya or any other way that you see now that you're reading the Cairo press? What they're saying about America?
I've been more engaged with talking to editors and reporters who have given me their opinions of Obama than I have been in actually reading the Cairo press, the English press. I didn't think was going to be giving me everything that I needed, because there's a certain dichotomy here. It's sort of a variant on the Vegas line. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in English stays in English.
Yeah.
And it's a much freer press, a much more open discussion than you would get in the Arabic press. And in my 5 days here, I haven't really spent a lot of time there. But I can tell you that there's a range of views on Obama and on the NATO campaign. I think the people that I've spoken to, the human rights activists I've spoken to, speak with just disappointment about the double standard, the realpolitik that allows America to take some action against Libya but none in Bahrain or in Saudi Arabia. I don't think that anybody is demanding, you know, why didn't America arm the rebels? But there is tremendous concern about civilian death in the recent NATO strike. I don't get the sense that they're dumping particularly on America here. I think they do understand that this is still their struggle, but there is a palpable disappointment that help hasn't come sooner and hasn't been more effective.
So if you had the chance to do what you said on your show last week, to live the joke that begins, a Muslim, a Copt, and a Jew walk into a bar...
Actually, we did that today, and it turned out that the Copt got a Heineken, the Jew had a Bloody Mary, and the the Muslim had a mango shake.
There's a punchline in there somewhere. And you had the Egyptian staple kushari for dinner this week?
Oh, my God. Who told you that? Yes, I did. And I think that I probably won't need to eat again for another 6 months.
A little Libyan birdie told me that. Live from Cairo, Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media. We'll be listening to your show this weekend. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, not straying too far from that region, we will look at one of the longest standing remaining strongmen in Africa, Robert Mugabe, who, among many other things, is one of the last leaders standing, maybe the last, to support Gaddafi in Libya. Can the democracy movement come to Zimbabwe? And then Brooklyn writer Hamilton Kane on revisiting his Southern Baptist roots after living the New York secular life. Stay with us.